the World Heart Podcast. I'm Pablo Perel, Senior Science Advisor at the World Heart Federation. We're recording this episode as part of our hypertension series for May, as May 17 is World Hypertension Day. Today we are discussing an issue that remains one of the biggest unfinished challenges in cardiovascular prevention, salt consumption. And more specifically, we'll be talking about potassium-enriched salt substitutes. To unpack this, we are delighted to welcome Bruce Neal, who is Professor of Medicine at the University of New South Wales, Professor Fellow at the George Institute for Global Health in Australia, and for us, very importantly, he's a member of the WHF Science Committee, and he's one of the world-leading researchers on salt reduction, hypertension, and cardiovascular prevention. Bruce, wonderful to have you. Welcome.
Thanks, Pablo. It's a pleasure to be here.
So maybe let's start with the very beginning and simple question. For some of our listeners, they might say, okay, why salt? I mean, why salt again? We know everything. This is kind of an old topic. Can you make the case why salt intake is still such a major global health issue, Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's an old issue. Everyone's known that salt is a problem for literally decades. And the challenge isn't really the science and knowing what the problem is. The challenge is being able to do something about it. So just for a bit of context, during most of hominid evolution, our ancestors probably ate about half a gram of sodium, which is just over a gram of salt a day. Over the last couple of hundred years, salt has become really prevalent in the food supply. And now average global salt consumption is about 10 grams a day or about 4 grams of sodium. So it's about 8 to 10 times above what it's meant to be. And this has, as we've known for a long time, huge impacts in terms of blood pressure and the risks of blood pressure related diseases.
So can you remind us what's the target that WHO, for example, recommends in terms of sodium consumption?
Yeah, so the target that WHO recommends is 2 grams of sodium or 5 grams of salt. And about a decade ago, the member states of the United Nations got together and agreed that this was a good target and that everyone would work towards it and try and achieve a 30% reduction by 2025. And again, coming back to this problem of having the aspiration versus the ability to do it, literally tens or even 100 countries said, yes, we will try to achieve this, but none have actually managed to deliver on that objective. And that is because it's simply really difficult to get salt out of the diet.
So none of the countries achieved that reduction, and how many are, below the target?
Oh, so I don't think there's a country below the target, and none have achieved the target, and none are likely to achieve the target in the next 5 years either. So it's a really difficult thing to try and achieve.
Yeah, so I think to frame the problem, as you said, it's clear that if not there's no country achieving that, and we are all the countries above the target, it's clearly a very, current problem and still unsolved. So moving into what to do with this, again, for years we have heard different intervention, eat less salt, from public health institutions, from governments, and you said the progress has been very, very limited. What is different about, and I know you've been working, and I would like to talk with you more in detail about potassium-enriched salt, what it makes different from other strategies. What it is, can you explain briefly what it is and why this would be different from other strategies?
If we come back, first of all, to, you know, why have we failed on this strategy of trying to get people to cut salt, whether that be individuals or industry, it really comes down to one pretty basic thing, which is that if you take salt out of food, it tastes less salty. And if it tastes less salty, people don't like it as much as when it tasted saltier. And it turns out that that is a pretty much intractable problem, whether you're an individual or whether you're a corporation. And it's only, you know, sort of weirdos like myself who will actually take salt out of their diet and stick with it long term. So we recognized this was a problem 20 years ago, and came across this idea of instead of trying to cut salt, let's switch salt. And the idea behind switching is that if you can switch to something that still looks and tastes like salt, but doesn't have the same harms, maybe you can get some progress that way. And so this is the idea behind a potassium-enriched salt. So regular salt is 100% sodium chloride. Potassium-enriched salt takes some of that sodium chloride and replaces it with potassium chloride. And that has two benefits. So the first is you end up eating less sodium chloride, so that lowers your blood pressure. You also end up eating more potassium. And potassium, is one of the key reasons that fresh fruits and vegetables are good for you. And it actually also lowers blood pressure. So if you eat more potassium, you get an additive blood pressure lowering effect from that. And once again, the amounts of potassium that we eat now are hugely different from what we ate during human evolution. So if we again, take that back to what did our hominid ancestors eat? Well, they probably ate about 10 grams of potassium a day in a Paleolithic diet, whereas average global consumption now is less than 2 and 2.5 grams. So with the potassium-enriched salt, you get to correct the sodium abnormality a bit, the potassium abnormality a bit, but most important of all, potassium-enriched salt looks and tastes like regular salt. So you don't have that barrier, that taste barrier to get over.
So it sounds like a clear, I mean, logic and very attractive. What's the evidence about this? I mean, what and I know you've been involved in doing trials on this topic, and but more generally, what's the evidence showing in terms of outcomes, particularly on blood pressure or any hard outcomes like stroke and cardiovascular events?
Yeah, so there's been about 20 to 25 randomized trials that have looked at the effects of switching from regular salt to potassium-enriched salt done over the last 20 or so years. And they're all pretty consistent in showing that they lower blood pressure, and that the taste is highly acceptable, in a way that trying to cut salt intake isn't. The real sort of pivotal moment came about 4 or 5 years ago with the completion of a really large trial called the Salt Substitute and Stroke Study, which was supported by our team. And what we did in that study was we took 21,000 people who were at elevated risk of stroke, living in rural China, and we randomly assigned them half to continue regular salt and half to switch to a salt substitute that was 25% potassium chloride, 75% sodium chloride. And then we followed them for 5 years. And what we found was very clear evidence that it would lower blood pressure. So mean blood pressure was about 3.5 millimeters systolic lower in the intervention group. But it also reduced the risks of stroke, major cardiovascular events, and premature death. So stroke went down by 14%. Major cardiovascular events by 13% and premature death by 12%. And these all had highly significant p-values associated with them.
Definitely a landmark study. And by the way, to our audience, we're going to put the key papers that we refer in this conversation with Bruce, so you can all look at the key studies we are referring to. But of course, I mean, one of the things you talk about, I mean, the benefit, but part of the discussion when we talk about this intervention are the safety concerns, particularly with hyperkalemia. And can you tell us a little bit more about what the evidence shows and what we know about this?
Yeah, so the concern is that you're adding potassium to the diet and that this could cause abnormal and seriously high levels of blood potassium levels. And this is certainly a possibility, and in some circumstances, it almost certainly is a real risk. So if you are taking a potassium supplement, if you are using a potassium sparing diuretic, probably you are at elevated risk. But the greatest concern is people who have kidney disease, because clearly, if you have kidney disease, you don't handle potassium as well. Now, there's obviously a large proportion of the world's population that have kidney disease. Probably about 10% has some form of chronic kidney disease. But the vast majority of that is stage 1, 2 kidney disease. And the Available evidence suggests that if you've got stage one or stage two kidney disease, you're very unlikely to get hyperkalemia as a consequence of having switched from regular salt to potassium-enriched salt. For stage three, four, and five, I think there's genuine uncertainty at the moment because there simply aren't the data available. Certainly, when we're advocating for the wider use of potassium-enriched salt, we're saying if you've got stage four or five kidney disease, you probably don't want to be using this product. Stage three, I think, is more difficult because actually most people with stage three kidney disease still handle potassium pretty well. And of course, people with kidney disease are at massively increased risks of cardiovascular events and blood pressure-related events. So if you do the modelling, what you find is that even under worst case assumptions, you still get huge net benefit, even in people with kidney disease. But of course, it's a very difficult public health message and a very difficult clinical message to sell that you are likely to get benefit, but you could cause harm. I mean, we've managed it in other scenarios. We give people for stroke prevention, we give them aspirin, and we know that some of them will bleed. We've learned to accept that, but we are not at that point yet with potassium-enriched salt. So the bottom line is that there almost certainly is a risk there, but it's also almost certainly being massively overestimated by almost everyone who is concerned about it.
Yeah, maybe we'll come back later to research questions that you think are important to address. But I think it's interesting, probably with many topics in cardiovascular prevention, but with salt and this example in particular, this tension between a population, if you want, approach to the problem and the individual approach and how we think. And I think we are both, I mean, doctors and epidemiologists, and we navigate between these two kind of visions. So if you think from a population health approach, you can see the benefits, but at individual level, sometimes it's a kind of different thinking. But I think we'll come back to some of the key research questions. I want to hear what are you working or what you think is important. But before that, so we talk about the problem and this potential, I mean, this intervention and the evidence supporting it. What the guidelines say about this? So can you tell me, and I know you've been looking at this, what the current guidelines, maybe you can refer to the latest AHA or ESC guidance and WHO recommendations, particularly on this topic.
Yeah, so I think probably the most important recommendation to come out recently has been that from the WHO, who now have a specific guideline on the use of low sodium salt substitutes, and they make a specific recommendation around people with elevated blood pressure levels and say that if they're going to use salt, they should switch to a low sodium salt substitute. So I should say potassium-enriched salts have lots of names. There's potassium-enriched salt, low sodium salt substitute, and probably some others as well. What we've also been trying to do is get all of the hypertension guidelines as they're updated around the world to also include a specific recommendation around the use of potassium-enriched salt, because almost all of the guidelines, whether they're hypertension guidelines, stroke guidelines, make a recommendation around trying to reduce dietary sodium. But almost none of them currently make a specific recommendation around using potassium-enriched salt. And we think that's probably important because, as I said earlier in the discussion, it's so hard to get people to reduce dietary salt. But if we give them a specific recommendation around potassium-enriched salt, probably what we're doing is giving them a practical way to actually do something that we've been trying to get them to do for 20, 30, or even 40 years.
Thank you. And I think, I mean, as you said, the WHO, again, another one, we're going to put the link. I think it's an important new guideline on this. And I think the American guideline refers to it as well now.
It does. So both the European and the American guidelines within their recent updates have included specific commentary about using potassium-enriched salt as a way to achieve sodium reduction.
And are you happy with what they say?
Yes, no, I mean, I think it's great, to have them make a specific recommendation when there wasn't one there before is fantastic. Do they go far enough? Well, I'm a bit of a believer, and probably I'm prepared to stretch the evidence base into areas where that perhaps isn't, quite such direct evidence. And it comes back to the question that you were alluding to, which is what additional research do we need to do? I mean, almost certainly potassium, like sodium, is an important cause of high blood pressure, not just in hypertensive people, but also in non-hypertensives. It's probably also associated with the rise in blood pressure with age. And therefore, there's probably a pretty strong argument for using potassium-enriched salt across the whole population. But at the moment, most of the evidence is restricted to people with hypertension or with existing disease. That's so often where we start in cardiovascular trials because it's easier to answer the questions there.
By the way, I mean, talking about the name, I also thought this, the same. I mean, there are different ways you refer to. I mean, it might help to have to go with one so people can stick with the name. I'm sure you had the discussion, no? Because sometimes I think it doesn't help. I mean, the cause if you're using different names.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Pablo. I mean, we've gone with potassium-enriched salt because one of the big problems, particularly in the food industry sector, has been that anything that has low sodium or reduced sodium is instantly perceived as less taste or reduced taste. And the potassium-enriched sort of gives it that positive feel. So that's what we're advocating for. But it's fair to say that hasn't been picked up globally as yet.
We talk about, I mean, the problem, the evidence, the guidelines, and of course, the key thing, I'm sure we're both interested, is implementation. So, what is happening in terms of implementation of potassium-enriched salts, and what are the main barriers for implementation? And I want, I mean, not we can cover later about the typical more clinical angle, but I want you to share what are the systems barriers for implementation, mainly issues about supply chain, affordability, availability, and so on.
Yeah, so the world eats quite a lot of sodium chloride every year, and the world produces that in m many different ways, but particularly from drying seawater, making salt out of seawater in pans. It's mined as well, and if we wanted, say, to replace a quarter of the world's sodium chloride with potassium chloride and switch the entire world's salt supply, we would need tens of millions of tons of potassium chloride of a food grade. Now, potassium chloride comes from potash, and potash is sort of everywhere, but mostly potash at the moment is mined and used for agricultural purposes, for fertilizers, and for some chemical purposes. So the first thing that we need to do is greatly increase global production of food grade potassium chloride. And there are a couple of ways that that might be achieved that we're looking at the moment. One is simply to mine and refine more potash into food grade potassium chloride. But there are also potentially some interesting options around recovering potassium chloride from the waste streams of other industries. And just to give you an interesting example, in Australia has a big winemaking industry. A big part of the waste stream from the winemaking industry is wastewater, and that wastewater contains a lot of potassium chloride. Wouldn't it be great if instead of having to mine and refine potassium chloride from potash, we could actually recover potassium chloride from the waste stream of an industry such as the wine industry? Potentially, there are actually many more industries. We're just exploring that at the moment. That might also help us with the second problem, which is about price. So at the moment, potassium chloride in general is about four times the price of sodium chloride in bulk. It's still a very low cost commodity. And if you cut it in a 25-75 mix, it means that potassium enriched salt is only twice as expensive as regular salt, which is a very low cost commodity. But that price barrier is a big issue, particularly if you're working in a low middle income setting or if you're working in the industrial setting and using very large quantities. So we need to figure out how to change manufacturing supply, both to get more into the system, but also to bring the price down. The next part is really awareness and availability and accessibility, all those sort of marketing type things. So we need community to know about it, we need clinicians, and we need the rest of the healthcare sector, so pharmacists, dietitians, physiotherapists, everyone to know about potassium-enriched salt, so that it's something that is discussed routinely as part of people's care. And we also need to get industry to be aware of it, so that they start switching it in their supply, in what they use when they're making food products.
Yeah, I mean, I see. I mean, definitely some challenges ahead, but clearly you're working on them, and I'm sure a large team and different groups in the world. I want to come back in terms of, I mean, lower middle income countries in particular. As I mean, we have a specific interest in global health and LMICs. What's do you have any data on availability, particularly in LMICs, regarding potassium-enriched salts? Is data on that?
Yeah, so potassium-enriched salts are available in about 60 or 70 countries worldwide out of the 190, I think it's 194 countries in the world. So there's reasonable availability. Use is probably still less than 1% of all salt consumed in any country is potassium-enriched salt. And availability is definitely less in low middle income countries than in higher income countries and higher middle income countries. You can achieve pretty massive change, though. I mean, when we first started working on these products in China, we could find two or three products available 10 years ago on the supermarket shelves in China. Colleagues went back recently and surveyed the supermarket shelves in China, and there are more than 100 products. So you can get really, really big change. And low middle income countries are a really interesting option as well for potassium-enriched salt, because the easiest way to replace potassium-enriched salt is to get people who cook most of their food in the home to replace the salt in that food. And to do that by buying, instead of buying regular salt, buying potassium-enriched salt. And low middle income countries, still more than 50% of the salt that you eat in most countries comes from that so-called discretionary salt that you add in the home. And the advantage of that is that you haven't got to try and get 50, 100, 1,000, 10,000 food companies to actually change their practices. You've just got to get a different product on the shelves of perhaps half a dozen supermarkets. So from a tractability, feasibility perspective, low middle income country settings are a high priority. Plus, of course, that's where most of the cardiovascular disease and the burden occurs, and where the problem of hypertension is most prevalent.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really interesting point about the source of salt in LMICs and how this can have a potential even larger impact and more maybe quick impact in these settings. You talk about the main, one of the most important barriers from a health system or, I mean, commercial determinants of production and availability. What about, you think, provider barriers are did you look, I mean, I'm sure you've done and your team some qualitative work about how doctors or I mean the community patients deal with this. Are there barriers in terms of use of potassium enriched salts as well?
Yeah, so probably the biggest barrier is awareness. Most people just simply don't know about it. And that's why we're really focused on trying to get clinical guidelines updated in the first instance. Availability, when we talk to clinicians, I mean, in Australia, and they go, well, I have sort of heard of it, but I'm a bit reluctant to recommend it because I don't know where my patients can get it. Safety is definitely something that comes up, and we'll come back to the need for perhaps some more research there. And then price. We've sort of probably mentioned then all of the key barriers that come up time and again when we look at the sort of the provider and the end user.
Thank you. Going to final reflections on three areas that I would like to hear you. So maybe we can start with research. What do you think are the key research questions that as a community we need to tackle? You mentioned already something on advocacy, but maybe you want to stress some key messages and policy. So what are your key recommendations on these three aspects?
Okay, so starting with the research piece, I think that probably the most important thing will be some research that randomizes people with stage three kidney disease to potassium-enriched salt or not, and looks both at, does it lower blood pressure? I'm pretty sure it will, but particularly looking at the effects on mean blood potassium levels and the effects on risks of hyperkalemia. Of course, it's very difficult to study effects on hyperkalemia robustly because it's a very infrequent outcome. I mean, I should say that in the big trial we did in China, the salt substitute and stroke study, we recorded about 130 cases of possible hyperkalemia during the whole study. We didn't routinely measure blood potassium levels the whole time, I should say. These were clinical cases of potential hyperkalemia, and there was no difference between the two groups. And they were a group that were vascular paths and potentially a whole bunch of people who had undeclared kidney disease. But we still need more evidence there. The next space where I think that would be really good to have more evidence is the effects in non-hypertensive or pre-hypertensive patients for the prevention of hypertension, because the evidence base there is it's reasonable for sodium, but it's less strong for potassium, and there's not much for potassium-enriched salts. And I think that would be a really big deal. And the other area where I'm really interested in is the potential for use in pregnancy. We know that, preeclampsia, particularly in low middle income countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, is a really big problem. And it's really challenging to, one, identify who might get preeclampsia, but then two, to treat in these settings. And again, a simple blood pressure lowering intervention might be worth looking at in that setting as well. Those are probably the really big areas.
Are you already working on any of these? Is any ongoing study on these topics that you can talk about?
Yeah, so we do have a study with colleagues in China, which looked at stage two and a few stage three kidney disease, which has just completed. I can't share the results yet, but that will hopefully come out in a few months' time. And we have funding applications in for all of those projects at often more than one agency. We also have another funding proposal in, which is to try and see if we can attenuate the rise in blood pressure with age. So again, as you're aware, blood pressure goes up progressively with age in almost every society, but that's not normal. I mean, if you look at, Amazonian Indian or sort of completely unacculturated populations, blood pressure when you're 60 is the same as blood pressure when you're 16. It's very likely that excess sodium consumption is a key reason why blood pressure goes up, not just acutely, but in a cumulative way. So we also would like to randomize a large number of people, get lots of blood pressure measurements over time, and see if we can change the slope of the rise in blood pressure over. We think you could probably do it in a 3 or 4 year period if you had a large number of people. So that would be incredibly powerful too, because if you could change the rise, if we could even attenuate a little the rise in blood pressure with age, the global health impact would be enormous.
That sounds, really interesting. A lot of studies to be following, I'm sure, in the future, and a lot of work to do on these. So, move to advocacy and policy recommendations.
I mean, from an advocacy perspective, and they sort of link up with policy. The advocacy policy sort of piece, has quite a lot of overlap there. For us, it's about trying to raise awareness with everyone, really, from a poli for, from a policymaker government type level through to the sort of societies who have, so much influence around blood pressure and cardiovascular disease in countries, but then also thinking about how do we go directly to community groups, because and that's actually a great opportunity, because when you start talking about food and doing research about food compared to about medicines, the level of community interest that you're able to generate is quite unbelievable. I mean, I keep coming back to it, but the salt substitute and stroke study has a, I don't know if you know, the altmetric impact score, which is heavily leveraged by sort of community general media type uptake. The impact score for that project is off the planet. I mean, it's the 500 biggest impact score out of 35 million things that have ever been scored. And I'm sure it's simply because it's about salt and a food and a big trial. So really don't want to underestimate the potential to get that sort of earned media with the general community to try and raise awareness and increase advocacy in this space. Obviously, having groups like World Heart Federation, World Stroke Organization, International Societies of Hypertension, etc., behind it is also a really big deal, as well as having that WHO guideline, which has been a massive boost.
In terms of measurement of sodium consumption, is there any, how are we doing? I know, I mean, what are the sources of sodium consumption, and is there any message, I mean, there of things that need to be improved? Do we have good data on this globally?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, the message on measuring sodium potassium consumption is that it's really difficult to do at an individual level, but you really don't need to, because the levels of consumption now are so different to what we evolved on and what we know are safe levels of consumption. 10 grams of potassium versus 2.5 grams now. Half a gram of sodium versus 4 grams now. If we get caught up in the issue of trying to measure it for individuals or populations, I think we're just putting a big barrier up to something that just needs to be got on with.
You mentioned a little bit about how different it is to work on a topic like this, that is food. I'm interested to find how did you end up working on salt? I mean, what was the trigger? I mean, you have such a passion for and for salt, and I'm sure for everyone listening to this, I mean, I'm sure anyone working on global cardiovascular research and interest in global on global cardiovascular health will know about you, about your work, but maybe, I mean, they have the opportunity to hear why did you get into salt? I mean, how was that?
The beginning of my career was very much about blood pressure lowering drugs and drug therapies, and I was lucky enough to be involved in some of the sort of pivotal large scale trials of ACE inhibitors, diuretics, secondary prevention, and gained that really strong sense of how important blood pressure was as a risk factor, but also how we were sort of dabbling a bit around the edges by just going after the people who had already had events or who were already diagnosed and wanted to look at that upstream piece. But then also because of that experience working in the drug space where we did large scale trials that showed effects on definitive outcomes, wanted to see if we couldn't generate that same level of evidence in the food space, and particularly in the salt space. And I guess that was the beautiful thing about the potassium-enriched salt option, was that maybe we could do a large trial of the sort that we did in the drug space. And that was really what got me passionate about it.
So to finish, we always ask our guests to share in a very simple way, what do you understand by global cardiovascular research?
I think for me, it's thinking about research which has potentially got a worldwide impact, and I guess with a real focus on low middle income country settings, not just high income country settings. That's how I tend to think about it.
Yeah, and I'm sure you're doing that and very well, Bruce. So thank you very much. It has been really interesting and enlightening discussion about the topic.
Thanks, Pablo.
To our listeners, we will link the key papers and guidelines below the podcast. Stay tuned for the next hypertension related podcast. We'll be talking more on hypertension management. And until then, please stay tuned, and thank you very much for listening to the World Heart Podcast.